Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowery. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking with glass artist Jack Wax. Jack, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tim.
Did I get that right? The glass artist?
No. Artist who uses glass.
What's the difference?
Glass artist makes you think of some people like Stale Patchouli and that sort of ilk make glass art. And glass art is not, hopefully, what I make.
So Patchouli, who for the people out there have no idea who he is, tell us a little bit about that. So we can get a context of
Yeah, a lot of people know Dale Patchouli and...
including you.
Sure.
Right.
Well, it's just because of his visibility, that's what people think glass is, which is a lot of shine and color. That is an aspect of the materials.
Well, before we get too far down the road, let's tell folks a little bit about you, who you are. You work at VCU.
It's my fifth year here at Commonwealth University, and... prior to that, I was teaching at Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois.
In Normal, Illinois.
Normal, Illinois, yes. Yeah,
it's almost as good as Hope, Arkansas.
Well, yeah, but you know...
Except it's more normal, I know.
Except for it's hard to live the rest of your life in the Midwest.
Right.
So I wanted to get back to the East Coast. Prior to that, I was living in Japan for 6 years, teaching at a school called Toyama Gurasuzoke Kenkyujo. And on the west coast of Japan, which was wonderful.
Was it? Maybe we can do the rest of the interview in Japanese. Wait a minute. I can't speak Japanese.
Dikinai watashi.
I'll ask questions in English and you can answer in Japanese. Yeah, Would that be good?
The show will become international.
So the one thing that you skipped in your rundown was, I'm assuming you're not doing janitorial work at VCU or... You know, what do they call it now?
Yeah, what do I do at VCU?
What exactly?
I am the, according to my chair, I'm the leader of the glass area. That's my title.
I used to be
the head, but I think that was from the 60s.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
So now you're the leader.
I lead the glass area, which involves 80 undergraduate students and 6 graduate students focusing on material exploration.
Okay.
That's what it is.
So where did this all start for you? I mean, most people in our culture, when they're young, they don't think to themselves, I think what I'm going to end up doing is working in glass and sculpting in glass and creating things. How did this happen? How, Jack,
a lot of,
did your life come to this?
A lot of living without planning. I think that's probably the first step. Following the heart versus the head.
Yeah. Is that really true?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, for me.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I don't know how much time you have here on this program, but, when I was a small child, I didn't want to live in the 20th century.
Really?
Yeah, I wanted to either live in the 15th to the 18th century or the 23rd or 25th century. I really didn't feel comfortable in the 20th century. So I became really, I guess, interested in archaeology and, paleoanthropology. That was really my interest as a young child. Yeah. And also kind of, a level of geology too, where I would do a lot of, just digging in the earth, probably to a larger extent than most kids do, besides trying to dig through to China, which I think a lot of kids do.
Yeah, I tried that.
But anyway, so from all that, I just was really interested in pre-culture or pre-cultural artifacts was what really interested me. So when I went to college, I actually started as an art historian, but I was really interested in sort of the pre-cultural artifact.
Uh-huh.
And
what does that mean?
Well,
pre-cultural artifact.
It,
I mean, you're talking about...
I'm talking about what, you know, the delineation of when civilization, you know, culture is a product of agriculture.
So you're talking about cave paintings? You're talking about...
Well, it doesn't have to be cave paintings. You know, small objects, anything that's modified, a stone, a piece of wood, a bone, some clay, and maybe even the ephemeral quality of a lot of work, which doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
But that's what really interested me. And when I went to a progressive experimental university in upstate Vermont called Goddard College at that time, and it was a totally self-directed program, and I just decided, yes, I would start and finish my own art history program, you know, with all of the boldness of a 18-year-old. And when I went up there, I went into the library, and, you know, it was a little bit boring just to spend all day every day in the library, especially when you're in upstate Vermont in the winter. And there's
especially it's Goddard's library.
6 feet of snow.
Which I think at that time Goddard's library had 14
it was new.
Books. Is
no,
that right?
No, it was the roof didn't leak and the carpet wasn't stained.
Oh, it was new.
It was new.
Okay.
Yeah, Pratt. It was 1970s.
The reason Jack and I are winking and joking at each other here is that I also attended Goddard. So,
you're
listening to the intellectual output of a small New England radical university.
So anyway, at Goddard College, of all places, they had a glass program. And I...
Really?
I backed into it, and I saw it as something that I didn't know people still did. I thought it was a 19th century or 18th century activity, and so that tied into my interest of something which didn't belong in the 20th century.
Yeah.
So that was my initial attraction, and I always tell my students the reason I started working in the material was I thought that in 5 or 6 years it would disappear from the face of the earth, and then it would be something I could tell my grandchildren that I'm not going to have about,
right.
Which is just the fact that I was one of the last people on the earth ever to do it. And that's why I started.
Really?
If I had known it was
what kind of work were you doing?
If I had known it was the beginning of something, I probably wouldn't have done it. I thought it was going to be the end.
Right. You thought you're only going to have to do this for a couple of years,
35
right?
35 years later, my students say, "How long have you been doing this?" And I just say, "Too long." But what kind of work was I doing prior to that?
Yeah, I mean, when you started doing this, were you you know, because you're not doing this now, and we'll get to that. But, I mean, were you blowing glasses? Were you blowing vases? Were you just melting blobs of glass? I mean, what were you?
No one knew what they were doing, technically. Mm-hmm. We had very, very, very low skills. The equipment was everything was very primitive. Our technique was primitive. The equipment was primitive. Our knowledge was, you know, nil, minuscule. We didn't know.
Do you think
anything.
This was true across America at the time?
Yeah, it was
In terms of an art form, not in terms of a. If you wanted to go out and get a vase or if you wanted to go out and get something like that, weren't there.
No.
Companies doing anything?
Well, this is 1972, and the first glass program in the United States was started in 67, 68. So there really hadn't been...
So people really literally had not been doing this for 100 years or so?
They had not been doing it for... if you rewind the tape, you can actually go back and see where there was no such thing as a private studio where people made glass. Traditionally, there was a factory. And there was never anyone that had it in their backyard or as a one-person ceramic studio or a wood shop.
So it was all pretty much utilitarian. These were objects that were to be used.
Utilitarian or the decorative arts.
Or decorative, yeah.
Yeah, there was very little of it being used as an artist material. No, it was a phenomenon of the late 60s.
So you're going to deny this, but you are one of the pioneers then in approaching this way.
I'm actually... officially known as a third generation individual because, I mean, the first two generations started real quickly. The first person who started the first program and then their first student, which graduated 3 years later, and then I was a student of those students.
Right.
So I was the third generation. I don't know what generation we're up to now. We're probably the 60th or something.
Right.
But I don't know. It probably doesn't mean anything in the long run.
Well, it means something in terms of creating an art form in this country.
Yeah, well, it is kind of interesting because after I went to Japan in the 90s, and here was a place where there was only one program in the entire country. I went to England in the mid-70s, and it was the same thing. At the Royal College of Art was the only program in the entire country coming out of the States, where the first program was the University of Wisconsin, Madison, 67, 68.
Figures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then within 5 years, there was probably 20 programs by the late 70s, You know, I mean, now there's hundreds of programs, so it snowballed. But, you know, having left the States in the late, in the early 90s and gone to Japan, back to a country where there was only one program in the entire country.
Well, let's talk about Japan, yeah, because that's an enormous shift. Mm-hmm. And also, I would guess, I mean, I know you well enough to know you're not going to admit to this, but that sounds like a pretty gutsy move. Mm-hmm. Did you speak Japanese?
No, I didn't speak a word of Japanese.
Got there off was the one plane. One glass school. Didn't speak any Japanese. Tell me about that.
I use funny words like blessing when I say that word, which is, I'm not a religious person, but you know, sometimes the stars do align. So I ended up being invited through a series of events where in Japan, the situation is such that you it's very almost impossible for you to get a job if someone doesn't know you. You know, in the United States, it's a bad thing if it's not who you are, it's who you know. But in Japan, someone has to vouch for you. So that's how I ended up
Who vouched being for you?
Well, I had a student of mine who I had taught at Rhode Island School of Design. Uh-huh. And she was Michiko Miyake. Okay. And she went back, and that's how I was referred. Anyway, going to Japan was, it was a good time to go in my life, personally. Ending a lot of things and being free to do whatever I wanted. And you get off the plane and you go to a room and there's 15 incredibly enthusiastic young faces smiling up at you and you think you've probably made the right decision.
Is that different? Do you find that students' attitudes in Japan are different than students here?
Stick my foot in my mouth.
I'm asking you from a cultural standpoint, not from a value judgment standpoint.
It's a completely different culture. It's apples and oranges. It's not. Mm-hmm. If you travel the world as much, I mean, a lot, you'll find, if as a Westerner, when you go to Japan, there's very little ground to stand on. You're really trying to balance on a moving stream of water, because everything you understand to be solid is not.
I think that's true. I've heard people who come to this country say the same thing culturally here.
Right.
One of the things you don't understand. You think it's hard to learn a language. Try learning a new culture.
Right.
Yeah.
But the student, you know, I think the Japanese culture is very complex. It's very old, and there's a lot of underlying factors which control or affect behavior, the family unit, the societal unit, the verticality of the society. We would call it inequality, but it's just a vertical society. It's just a very different social structure, completely mm-hmm. different. Mm-hmm. But what happens is the people are given complete responsibility for themselves at a very young age. I mean, for example, I always use the fact that there's no janitors in any of the schools, because there doesn't have to be, because all the students clean up after themselves. I mean, that's a novel idea. But from kindergarten on to college, they just are continuously responsible for what mm-hmm. they do. The simplest thing is when you have a discussion in Japan with the students, they're continually listening intently, paying attention as to the greatest depth that they can, and they're also writing things down. Mm-hmm. And
now these are kids who are going to be artists or.
The school that I taught in was a special school, and it was as I said, each class was 15 students, and they ranged in age from 18 to 35.
Wow.
And some of them were right out of high school, and some of them had already finished art university. So it's a very interesting program, really diverse from all over the entire country. And it was very, very competitive, 250 applicants for 15 positions.
And what exactly were you teaching?
I was specifically head of the area where we were teaching glass fabrication skills.
What does that mean?
How to make things mm-hmm. With hot glass, mostly. That was my specialization at the school. But, inevitably I tried to impart ideas of what being an artist is or can be mm-hmm. In relationship to the culture and in relationship to modes of self-expression.
Is their sense of being an artist different than ours?
I mean, we
have that sort of cultural pop sense of, you have to be crazy and an alcoholic and a drug addict to make art in America, which anybody who's an artist knows is not true.
Sure.
The artists you and I know that are successful are disciplined, hardworking folks.
They only work 120 or 160 hours a week, unlike the people that go home at 5 o'clock.
They get to work any 160 hours a week they want.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there that similar kind of pop? What's the take on an artist in Japan? I mean, I know they have cultural, what do they call them?
Well, they have national treasures.
National treasures.
Yeah.
Which we don't.
No.
I mean, these are human beings we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that
the Grand Canyon.
For me, it took a while to find firm footing, you know, on the ground there because I couldn't figure out what was motivating people.
Yeah.
Because I was taught self-expression, angst.
Right.
And I finally, you know, I would talk to my students. I said, you know, what about passion? What about passion? And what about doubt? What about fear? And they would just look at me very calmly and say, you know, we understand that life is basically painful. And we look at art as an antidote.
That's amazing.
Pain. It's not.
Because I've asked artists sitting in the chair you're sitting.
No.
What about doubt?
Yeah.
What about fear?
Right.
What about loneliness in the studio by yourself? You know, all these things you have to overcome as an American artist. And what you're saying is those are born of a certain naivete about the nature of life.
Well, they're born of a certain cultural conditioning, I would say.
I mean, there's an expectation in our culture that you should not, that you have to overcome fear as opposed to be fear.
Right.
That you have to overcome, it's that sort of, is it that Western mentality of overcoming, and the Japanese are just saying, life.
In Japanese, there's a phrase called shogunai, which means, and that's the philosophy of life, which is means it can't be helped. Mm-hmm. So you don't fight against a lot of things because there's a lot of things that can't be helped.
So what did they say when you asked them about fear?
They said, they're not embracing the pain as a source of their work. They're embracing the work as an antidote to the pain. And I just said, that's certainly not wrong. And I thought, wow, that's great. You know, I mean, it's great to see.
How do you mean antidote of pain?
Well, I mean, it's not just that they're going to make something beautiful because life can be ugly.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some aspect of that beauty, you know, prior to being now reaccepted. In the 80s in America, you couldn't make beautiful art.
No,
but, you know,
it.
In Japan, it's never been abandoned. Mm-hmm. It's always been embraced.
And there's never been a big argument about, well, who defines what's beautiful and what isn't. It's kind of like, come on, guys.
Well, there's an understanding.
You look at it, it's beautiful, not beautiful.
Well, again, there's more of a cultural understanding. I mean, I don't want to talk about homogeneity of the culture, but there is that which you know, I think feeds into a certain kind of acceptance of norms, I suppose.
Right.
But the thing is, the artist there is not, you know, in America, there's this cultivation of, as you were saying earlier, outside of society. But the artist, and I forget who, I can't quote exactly who said this, but it's something I remember from undergraduate school. And the artist is a myth created by society and in conjunction with the artist. So it's a collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's this idea that, you know, being on the outside or being on the edge.
Right.
But the Japanese society doesn't look that way. No, the artist is as much a part of the culture as the policeman.
Really?
Yeah, it's very much an embracing of the role as, I don't want to say a valued part, but certainly an integral part of the entire culture.
So they're not sort of this outside of society, examining society, being the
conscience,
and seeing down the road and seeing that, not all of that stuff that's so typically American. You know, when you say to someone, you know,
well, certainly there's you know, world culture has affected world culture.
Sure,
so
right.
You know, the globalization, artists are global now, and when you have Nara or Murakami or some of those artists who are working in Japan now, they're very much aware, besides the fact that Nara actually studied in Germany. But
what do they work in?
Those are painters, actually, okay. both of those artists. And so they're much more aware of the global situation in the world, certainly the market of all things.
Right.
But, you know, from my experience directly living in the culture and working with the Japanese artists, I did really find to be a role which is within the culture,
mm-hmm.
Not glorified as being at the edge of the culture as much.
Is it supported more there? I mean, is it easier to live as an artist there?
Well, it's codified. Support? Yeah, there's, of course, anywhere besides America, there's more support for the arts. I mean, you know, go to Brazil, go anywhere in the world. I mean, you know, we don't want to get started on that. But, you know, I think that I have to qualify that as well, because Japan is a very tight society, so that if, per se, your father was a very famous artist, it's very easy for you to then make it as an artist.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a certain amount of continued, what we would label as ageism and sexism. So certainly if you're an older woman in Japan, it would be very difficult to be accepted as an artist.
Really?
But that's, you know, that's the reality.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, overall, I think that the society does make room for the artist as an integral member. I think, again, what they do there, in my estimation, as an outsider, and I can't say that I have access to a true understanding, only having been there for 5.5 years, is that there's a great deal of respect, and I really use that word, great deal of respect, for young people can carry on the work of their precursors.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in America, it's new, make it new, make it new, make it new, make it new. But in Japan, you know, new is maybe slightly suspect initially and mm-hmm. not as embraced as it is here.
Mm-hmm.
Well done is embraced.
Right.
Whatever that can mean. I mean, that's a broad area of everything that's, you know, come before. If you can do things really well, you're given respect.
I mean, that. What about the sort of the whole concept of postmodernism? What we went through in this country, for people who aren't familiar with that term, but, you know, sort of that a real skepticism that there's a right way to do things, or that there is a, you know, there are certain rules that you should follow, or that, you know, medicine is the right thing and it's going to cure all ills. You know, that right. sort of modernist thinking that, you know, we had for a long time, and all of a sudden things started to become so fragmented that it was harder and harder to hold that philosophy together, at least in the American mind.
Right.
And that may just be specifically cultural to America.
Mm-hmm.
Is there that kind of postmodern cynicism in Japan?
Of course, young people, it's, you know, it's like when they put on their jeans, it's the same thing every morning. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. I think that it has to be that way.
Yeah.
Maybe it has to do with hormone imbalances, but naturally.
Did you see the movie Babylon?
No, I haven't. But anyway.
Go see it.
All right.
There's a wonderful Japanese girl in it.
Yeah, I've heard.
Yeah.
I think that, again, all of that stuff is examined readily and heartily, and, you know, with true purpose by young people. But I would have to say, again, in my humble estimation, from my experience with the art scene and my limited experience there in Japan, is that after a certain period of time, you're supposed to become responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Probably much sooner than you have to in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So being responsible means you have to then serve the greater good, which is become a functioning member of society, whether it's an artist or a bank teller.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you have to assume your role and do it well and do it purposefully and do it in reverence and in reference to what's come before.
Mm.
So that's why I said there's this embracing of...
So when are you moving back to Japan?
if I could live there 3 months a year, it would be heaven on earth. But
okay.
I don't know if
we'll see if we can work that out for you.
I don't
you.
Know if I can do 12 months a year at this point.
Plus
my contract.
Well, we're getting close to the end here, believe it or not. Let me just ask you quickly, your work.
Oh, yes.
Are you showing anywhere right now?
I show at the Reynolds Gallery here in Richmond, Virginia.
If someone wants to see your work, is it on a website?
It should be at Reynolds.
Reynolds? Do you have any idea what their website is?
It's BevReynoldsGallery.com, I believe.
BevReynoldsGallery.com. Or Google it.
Yeah, Google Bev Reynolds.
What about at VCU? Are you on a website there?
I'm at the School of the Arts website. If you go to crafts/materials studies.
And how would you describe your work?
Oh, my work is in transition right now, thank God, which is the greatest thing ever, which is if your work's not in transition, then maybe you're sitting on your laurels.
A little stale,
but right now, I'm actually, as a sculptor, I'm drawing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with ink and vellum.
So you think of yourself more as a sculptor.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, yeah. A glass sculptor. A sculptor who uses glass as a medium.
There you go.
Got it.
My degree is in sculpture from Rhode Island School of Design.
Uh-huh, okay.
But the, that's my own issues, but the... You know, as I said, now I'm doing a lot of drawing. I'm working with ink and vellum a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm doing work which I hope will end up being large-scale wall drawings,
mm-hmm.
you know, temporal work, which I'll probably do with number 3B pencils on the wall and then, you know, paint over.
As a teacher,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Sort of a, I don't know if you can answer this question. What's one thing you would say to young students,
one
young
thing?
Glass students?
If you talk to my students, they'll tell you it's almost impossible for me to say one thing. That comes with the territory.
Okay, well.
One thing is let's rewind the tape and go back to what I tell them to do is I tell them to embrace doubt.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I do. I tell them that. And this is what I'll leave you with, if I have to leave you with anything. And that's with the idea that you have to be full of doubt and full of faith to make good work. And I believe that that's the way you make honest work.
It's very sort of zen, isn't it?
No, it's a quote from Bruce Springsteen.
Is it?
That's what he says before he goes on. The only
I've always thought
that
Bruce
reason,
Springsteen was the only Zen Buddhist
The
monk
only reason
in New Jersey.
He can perform at the level he performs is because right before he goes on, he absolutely knows he can't do it. And he also knows that he absolutely can. And that's what you have to do in the studio. Keep the doubt close. Who knows?
That's good. That's very good. Thank you very much.
No, thank you,
And thank you, folks, for tuning in to Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's indie radio. It's radio for the rest of us.